Even in the pre-dark days, the LAV-25 had been a mighty machine. These days, it was all but unstoppable. The light armored vehicle was a rolling powerhouse of steel and military tech. 8 great wheels supported a multi-ton chassis, the tires bulletproof even at point-blank range. The independent suspension allowed the juggernaut to cross the most rugged terrain imaginable, with little or no reduction in speed. The hull was waterproof up to the depths of 5 feet, and would float after that depth. 2 small propellers in the rear could propel it through water at a speed of nearly 30 miles per hour under ideal conditions, but it generally moved a lot slower than that. The belly was armored against landmines, the front window was made of bullet-resistant armor-lite plastic, and the louvered gun ports could be closed tight enough for the LAV to be gas-bomb-proof. There was even a heavy-duty winch on the front to assist the WAG to traverse steep hills or to pull itself out of a swamp. The companions would have used that to rein in the Hummer, but the cable couldn't be cut quickly, and timing had been of the essence. Designed for a crew of 6, plus 2 officers and a driver, the LAV had more than enough room for the 6 companions, plus numerous boxes of supplies from the deep storage locker. Blasters, ammos, grens, food, bedrolls, medical supplies. The wealth of the ancient world filled the deck, secured under camo netting or strapped down into empty jump seats set along the metal walls. Watching Jack pour yet another canister of condensed fuel into the machine, Ryan had to privately admit that although the LAV was impressive, it was far from being perfect. All of the fancy electronic gear was useless, zapped by the EMP of the nuke storms, or chilled by the long decades. The smoke generators were clogged solid with grease, and the control circuits for the 25mm minigun were fried. But those were minor considerations in comparison to the incredible rate that colossal Detroit engines consumed fuel. Even after the earlier fight with the Guardian, the tanks of the redoubt registered half full, which meant there was enough condensed fuel for 100 trucks working for 10 years. Juice enough for an army on the move. However, the huge tanks of the LAV could only hold so much, and Ryan had grudgingly allowed spare canisters of juice to be attached to the WAG's armored back end. Those would be a prime target for any cold hearts they encountered. A single round into one of the gas cans, and the LAV would be covered with flames. The WAG was supposed to be fireproof, but a single crack in the armored hull, or in the louvered gun ports, and the companions would burn alive. Jack screwed the cap back on to the 10-gallon container.
Tank's full. What do with this?
Set it aside. We're carrying enough as it is.
Nodding in agreement, Jack carried the sloshing container to the fuel pumps and put it out of the way. When he had first joined the companions and learned about the incredible redoubts, he could barely believe the tales of condensed fuel. The stuff looked and worked like regular juice, what Mildred called gasoline. Yet the fuel refused to evaporate, and an open cup of the stuff would still be there a month later, while gas would evaporate and be gone in less than a day. The Mattrans were useful, but it was the condensed fuel that truly impressed the teen. It was perfect for regular engines or diesel engines, which even Mildred couldn't explain, and nothing was better in a Molotov cocktail. It was just amazing stuff. Condensed fuel was even better than the nuke batteries, in his opinion.
One last check.
All the while they had been working, the companions kept a careful watch for any suspicious movements in the redoubt. They knew from experience that a Cerberus cloud could gain access to a redoubt, so if the black jelly was another Guardian, then it could also get inside. In an effort to counter that, Doc and Jack had stacked 12 full cans of fuel near the mouth of the access tunnel and disabled the fire suppressant system in the ceiling. If the blob appeared, a single gunshot in the cans would engulf the thing in flames. Unless they missed, or there were 2 of them. Meanwhile, JB had tried to attach the Vulcan minigun from the middle level of the redoubt to the top of the LAV, but Ryan had done too good a job of ripping out its control circuitry. Most of the normal mechanical controls were missing, and after several disastrous false starts, JB had finally admitted defeat. It was a rare occurrence when the armorer couldn't master a weapon, and he took the news in ill humor. Thankfully, the LAV wasn't completely unarmed. Aside from the rapid fires and grens of the companions, Jack and Doc had skillfully wired several Claymore anti-personnel mines to the angled sides of the WAG. Anything coming within 30 feet of the LAV would be blown in 2 by the stainless steel ball bearings and C4 plas packed into each Claymore.
That's it for me.
Mildred swung a bag of trade goods into the rear of the transport. The physician had carefully gone through the vault and chosen a selection of items that couldn't be used against them in a battle, but that would be priceless at any vill. aluminum mess kits, plastic combs, pocket mirrors, seed corn, Swiss Army knives, and such. Those were trinkets for the civilians. The nobles at Avil would get U.S. Army boots, live brass, and revolvers. However, nobody got a rapid fire, or grins. Already inside the LAV, Doc took the bag and stuffed it into a hammock rigged for carrying the more delicate of the cargo. The useless items, such as the radar, radio, and such, had been removed to make extra space, and every little bit helped. A couple of years earlier, in another armored wag they nicknamed Leviathan, the companions had filled a trailer and packed it full of supplies to drag along behind. They lost the trailer on the first day, and the resulting blast of the detonating spare ammo came perilously close to ending their lives. Since then, everything went inside a wag or was left behind. With the exception of those all-important gas cans, which would be disposed of quickly if necessary. Taking a jump seat set along the wall, Doc gave a grunt of discontentment. Oddly enough, a few months back they had encountered Leviathan again, assuming it was actually Warwag 1 based on some faulty info. But this time it wasn't under their control, and the resulting firefight had been hellishly fierce. The companions had won, but only due to the direct assistance of Kate, a traitor. Some people thought that the woman was the original traitor, the legendary master of the Deathlands, but the companions knew the truth. There were so many wheels within wheels, Doc mused, wiping off his hands. The Deathlands was filled with more mysteries than there were ways to die.
What do you think about calling this tin can Leviathan 2?
Stoically, Doc raised both bushy eyebrows.
Really now, madam, where is your originality?
Okay, it was just a thought.
Outside in the garage, Ryan did a last walk around the place, checking things over. There was no reason to think that once they departed the redoubt, they couldn't get right back inside, even if there was another of the jelly muties hiding in the water. But he liked to be prepared. What was it the traitor had liked to say? To achieve a victory, plan for failure. Smart words. JB rested a nuke lamp on top of the hood of a civvy station wagon.
Looking for something?
Nah, just doing a double check.
Ryan motioned at the nuke lamp.
How many did you make?
JB lifted the heavy device.
3. There were a lot more nuke batteries and headlights, but I couldn't find enough of the right kind of wire to retard the voltage from blowing the bulbs. But 3 will be enough.
In spite of the fact that the companions had been traveling through the Matran system for years, it was only a few months ago that JB came up with the brilliant invention of the nuke lamp. Candles were cheap, but blew out easily and never gave off much light. Road flares smoked and smelled awful, and also burned out quickly. Most flashlights required batteries that hadn't been manufactured in 100 years, and survivalist flashlights like Mildred's were incredibly rare. Then it occurred to the armorer that all of the military wags in a redoubt used a nuke battery to start the engines. The sealed power pack seemed to last forever and put out enough voltage to crank over even a tank engine. So, taking some wiring from a civvy car and doing some fancy soldering, JB soon built a nuke lamp. A nuke battery with a pre-dark headlight hardwired into place. The device gave off a blinding beam of white light, especially if a halogen lamp was used, and never ran out of power. Of course, the nuke lamps were much too heavy to carry in a backpack, occasionally short-circuited, and always died if they fell into water, but they were still better than anything else known. Christy lifted one of the nuke lamps in her free hand and thumbed the switch on top. From the headlight, a blue-white light beam shot out that cut across the garage like a laser.
Whatever else, at least we won't be in darkness anymore. We certainly could have used these when we were underground in Tennessee.
Ryan picked up the third nuke lamp.
All right, looks like we're ready as we'll ever be. Let's get moving.
As the three companions went to the rear door of the LAV, Mildred and Doc helped them in by taking the nuke lamps and tucking the devices under the jump seats. Jack stayed outside the wag, his MP5 rapid fire resting on his shoulder. He had decided to be the doorman for this run. Where there was one guardian, there could be more. Hopefully, the exploding Hummer had killed the jelly thing. But if half of it could still fight, then perhaps small pieces could too. He had seen a lot of strange things over the years, and most of them had tried to kill him. When in doubt, always assume the worst. Maneuvering through the jumble of supplies to reach the front of the wag, Ryan checked to make sure both Gren bins on the walls were full, then eased himself into the driver's seat. Taking the navigator seat on the opposite side, Christy flipped a few switches and started the electrical system. The internal lights pulsed a few times, then came on in a subdued glow. Checking a rearview mirror, Ryan waited for JB to close and latch the rear doors before starting the engine. The entire vehicle shook slightly as the four nuke batteries under the corrugated floor surged with power and turned over the massive 275-horsepower Detroit diesel. Instantly, the indicators on the dashboard came to life, the meters swinging promptly into the green zones for electrical power, fuel, oil, hydraulics, and engine temp. Turning a few dials, Christie killed the flashing red indicators, showing that there was trouble with the missing radar and radio equipment. They dimmed to a dull glow, but the strobing was still noticeable, so she placed a strip of duct tape over the lights to mask them from sight. Busting the bulbs would have been easier, but she hated to smash anything so incredibly old. Besides, the spare bulbs might come in handy someday. Shifting the transmission into low gear, Ryan started to roll forward and entered the tunnel, with Jack walking close behind. Reaching the blast door, Ryan eased to a halt. Standing at the keypad, Jack exchanged a glance with the big warrior behind the bulletproof windshield, then tapped in the exit code and pressed the lever. As the blast door started to ponderously move aside, Jack walked quickly to the rear of the LAV, where JB already had one of the armored hatches open and waiting. Jack quickly climbed inside and shut the hatch tight, making sure the lock was engaged. As the huge black exit door slowly began to open, the companions waited with bated breath for any sign of the Guardian or its spawn. But the watery tunnel appeared to be devoid of life. The charred wreckage of the Hummer stood off to the left, the nearby array of bricks cracked and discolored. Ryan turned on the headlights.
Roof looks solid.
Rolling to the very edge of the floor of the redoubt, Ryan studied the interior of the tunnel as the blast door completed its ponderous journey and boomed into the wall.
Hold on tight.
Everybody grabbed for the straps hanging off the interior walls as the one-eyed man switched on the eight-wheel drive and the big wag nosed into the tunnel. As the front tires cleared the floor, the prow of the LAV dipped downward, and then the front of the transport sharply dropped into the water. Thrown forward, the companions almost lost their seats. The rear of the LAV moved off the floor and also dropped into the flooded tunnel. Loose items went flying, and a couple of grins bounced out of open bins on the walls to roll freely on the floor. As the companions unbuckled their seatbelts and scrambled to reclaim the explosive charges, Ryan checked to make sure the internal seals were holding and no moisture was seeping into the wag. The dark waters rose to just below the window level. If the LAV flooded, they would probably have to use the top hatch to get out. But the seals registered tight, and there was no sign of leakage.
So far, so good.
Christie switched on the wiper blades to clear the dripping windows. The slightly blurry headlights of the vehicle extended far along the tunnel until the sheer distance rendered them useless. Checking out the side window, Christie saw that the nearby brick walls were dripping from the spray, and a choppy surface was still rippling with waves from their sudden immersion. Glancing over his shoulder, Ryan saw the others return the grins to the wall bins. JB used some of the duct tape to cover the open tops.
All clear. But it's a good thing we taped the handles on the grins. One of the arming pins came free, and if I hadn't shoved it back in less than 8 seconds...
JB spread his hands wide in the imitation of a detonation. Brushing back one of her beaded plaits, Mildred shivered at the thought of the charge going off inside the metal vehicle. There wouldn't have been enough of them remaining to mop up with a sponge from the explosive compression, and then the halo of shrapnel would have ricocheted off the armored walls for minutes, which was a lot longer than would have been necessary to reduce whatever was left of them into mincemeat. Mildred remembered a phrase she had heard once in an old black-and-white war movie.
Spam in a can.
It was a hell of a grisly image. Closing her eyes, Christie said a silent prayer to Gaia in thanks. Doc looked queasy from the implied results, and Jack popped a stick of chewing gum into his mouth and began contentedly chewing.
Just hope it doesn't happen again.
Better not.
Mildred leaned back in her seat. 5 minutes out of the redoubt, and they almost blew themselves up. It was a miracle that she didn't have gray hair yet. Tapping the sonar screen, Christie got no response. But even if the belly unit still had been working, that drop could have broken it. The LAV was tough, but not indestructible. Bobbing slightly in the dark water, the wag started forward, the eight huge wheels sending out a spray behind them. Switching on the propellers, Ryan felt the transport lurch and then begin to move faster and smoother, the RPM of the engine steadily rising as the temperature started increasing. Something was wrong with one of the air intakes. The damn engine was overheating already. Ryan cut off the propellers, and saw the temperature start to go back down, and settled in for a bumpy ride using just the 8 tires.
What do you think we'll find at the end, lover?
Hopefully a way out.
And if not?
Then we make one. We got enough plast to crack the moon.
True enough.
Then Christie settled in to watch the surface of the water for any suspicious movements.